much of his life to the study of strange psychological phenomena. Adhering to his mantra, "Whenever you can, count," he determined whether his colleagues' lectures were boring by measuring the level of fidgeting in their audiences, tested the power of prayer by calculating the average lifespan of priests, and spent months trying to brew the perfect cup of tea. In an essay entitled "Measurement of Character," Galton suggested that it might be possible to calculate the degree to which two people are in love by recording the inclination that they have for each other. Galton had noted that when two lovers sit at a dinner table, they visibly slope toward each other, and in doing so, place greater weight on the front legs of their chairs. The great scientist suggested that it might be possible to secretly incorporate a pressure gauge with an index and dial into the legs of everyday furniture, and thus objectively measure the extent of love. Galton ends his discussion of the matter by noting, "I made some rude experiments, but, being busy with other matters, have not carried them on as I had hoped. Victorian scientists were reluctant to modify their furniture along the lines Galton suggested, and the idea of measuring how lovers behaved faded. In fact, the idea of trying to record the behaviour of those in love didn't re-emerge until the 1970s. Rather than adopt Galton's idea of concealed gauges and dials, the work took a more observational approach. For several years, a small group of dedicated researchers boldly went where few psychologists had gone before and visited bars and parties. Once there, the researchers secretly observed the behaviour of couples in love. The results confirmed what most people would have suspected. Those struck by the love bug move physically close to each other, spend a long time looking into each other's eyes, play footsie under the table, mimic each other's body language, touch each other's hands and arms, and share secrets. Inspired by the way in which the as-if principle had been used to manufacture happiness, researchers wondered whether people would fall for one another if they behaved as if they were in love. One of the first studies was conducted by Kenneth Gergen from Swarthmore College. Couples often spend quality time together in the dark, and so Gergen wondered what would happen if he encouraged complete strangers to do the same. Gergen first covered the floor and walls of a 10-foot square room with padding, and asked groups of four men and four women to spend an hour in the room. After that, Gergen turned out the lights in the room and asked the groups of participants to spend 60 minutes in total darkness. Gergen used normal and infrared cameras to record what happened in the room, and also interviewed each participant after the experiment had finished. Describing his findings in an article entitled "Deviance in the Dark," Gergen noted that when the lights were on, none of the participants purposefully touched or hugged one another, and that 30% of them felt sexually aroused. When the group was plunged into darkness, the situation was very different. Now, almost 90% of them touched one another on purpose, 50% hugged, and 80% were sexually aroused. In addition, the people who were in the darkroom were far more likely to start talking about important events in their lives and find one another attractive. Gergen's footage revealed that a few of the participants even started stroking one another's faces and kissing. Simply by finding themselves in the sort of situation that lovers enjoy, people quickly started to behave as if they had been struck by Cupid's arrow, and so found one another more attractive. When it came to making love in the laboratory, this was just the tip of the iceberg. The power of footsie. Harvard psychologist Daniel Wegner wondered whether, in the same way that smiling makes people feel happy, having two strangers secretly play footsie might make them feel attracted toward each other. Mindful of the way in which those investigating the smiling makes you happy hypothesis had used various cover stories to prevent participants telling the experimenter what they wanted to hear, Wegner pretended he was conducting a study examining the psychology of poker. Volunteers were invited to Wegner's laboratory in groups of four. The experimenters scheduling the volunteers ensured that none of the group knew one another and that each foursome consisted of two men and two women. The researchers then split the volunteers into two teams, with each consisting of one man and one woman. The teams were told that they were going to play poker against each other, and the experimenters took the teams to two separate rooms to explain the rules of the game. In reality, one of the teams was taught how to cheat by secretly sending codes to each other during the game. And how were these codes relayed? The cheating couple were told to keep their feet constantly in contact throughout the game and tap out information to each other. In essence, they were made to play footsie. As soon as the game had finished, all of the volunteers were asked to rate the attractiveness of the other players. The couple who had been behaving as if they were in love found each other more attractive. Wegner was not the only one to try to conjure up love in the laboratory. In 2004, psychologists Arthur Aaron and Barbara Fraley from Stony Brook University in New York carried out a similarly strange, but equally insightful, study into the topic using several blindfolds and a packet of straws. Young lovers often have fun together, and so the researchers wondered whether encouraging people to behave as if they were having a good time in each other's company might pull them closer together. To find out, they invited participants to their laboratory, randomly paired them up, and then allocated them to one of two groups. In one of the groups, the couples had a great time. The researchers blindfolded one member of the couple and had the other hold a drinking straw between his teeth, after which the researchers arranged for the blindfolded person to try to learn dance steps by listening to instructions read by the straw-holding colleague. After that, the blindfold and drinking straw were removed, and one member of the couple was given a pad and pen. The other was secretly given the name of a simple object, such as a tree or a house, and without naming it, had to describe it while the partner attempted to draw the object. The couples in the other group weren't given the straws and blindfolds, and were asked to learn the same dance and draw the object under more straightforward circumstances. After the fun and games had stopped, all of the participants were asked to draw two overlapping circles to indicate the degree of closeness they felt with their partner. The pairs who had been behaving as if they were a happy couple felt significantly closer to each other. Over the years, researchers have conducted many similar studies. In some experiments, psychologists have pretended to test for extrasensory perception and had people stare into each other's eyes, while in others, they have encouraged complete strangers to share their innermost secrets with one another. Time and again, the results have shown that it is possible to conjure up Cupid. Making love. Encouraged by these findings, American psychologist Robert Epstein decided to take things one stage further. Was it possible, he wondered, to use these techniques to produce passion outside the laboratory? Epstein has had a colourful career. In his late teens, he felt a calling to become a rabbi, and so sold his possessions and headed for Israel. 6 months later, he decided that he had misunderstood the nature of his calling and returned to America, determined to make a significant and lasting contribution to mankind. He developed an interest in psychology and eventually enrolled as an undergraduate at Harvard. Publishing a remarkable 21 scientific papers in just 4 years, Epstein was excused from having to write a dissertation by the head of Harvard's psychology department, who advised him to staple some of your publications together and get out while you still can. A few years later, Epstein became the editor of the popular magazine Psychology Today. Back issues are affectionately referred to by psychologists as Psychology Yesterday. In 2003, he left the magazine and has since been researching a range of topics, including creativity, stress, adolescence, and love. Epstein is convinced that when it comes to love, the Western world is being sold a dangerous lie by fairy tales, romance writers, and Hollywood blockbusters. From a very young age, children read stories in which damsels in distress are swept off their feet by knights in shining armor, and love is portrayed as a mystical emotion created by magical kisses, mysterious potions, or the will of gods. Later in life, adults read books and watch movies about people searching endlessly for the one, and, if successful, living happily ever after. According to Epstein, these inaccurate conceptions of love seep into our minds and wreak havoc in our lives. He believes that love is not a magical process and that people are not destined to be with one specific person. Instead, Epstein is convinced that love develops according to established psychological principles and that almost any two people could fall for each other by behaving as if they are in love. The idea may sound outlandish, but there is some evidence that it might be true. Many celebrity couples have fallen for each other after acting out an on-screen romance. Richard Burton famously fell in love with Elizabeth Taylor when they were making the film Cleopatra. Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie fell in love with each other while playing husband and wife in Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And in Bugsy, Warren Beatty plays the role of the gangster Benjamin Bugsy Siegel, who instantly falls for a Hollywood starlet played by Annette Bening. Beatty and Bening married soon after filming. In each instance, the celebrities acted as if they were in love and promptly fell for each other for real. In June 2002, Epstein, then in his late 40s and single, announced that he intended to carry out a bold, very personal study to discover whether his theory about love was correct. Writing in Psychology Today, he described how he would try to find a woman who was willing to join him in an experiment to discover if it were possible for two strangers to learn to love each other. Rather than go through the horrors of dating, Epstein and the selected woman would spend between 6 and 12 months following a simple set of rules designed to bring them together, such as agreeing not to date others and to participate in exercise designed to promote love. And then co-author a book about their experiences, working title, The Love You Make, How We Learn to Love Each Other and How You Can Too. Explaining that the idea was not just a publicity stunt, but a serious study into the nature of love, Epstein said that several large publishing houses had already shown an interest in the book. The idea was quickly picked up by the media, and more than 1,000 women volunteered for the experiment. Epstein met 15 of the applicants, but rejected them all, later explaining that many of them appeared more interested in obtaining publicity than genuinely learning to love him. Then, on Christmas Day 2002, Epstein was on a flight and found himself seated next to a Venezuelan ex-ballerina named Gabriela Castillo. The two of them started to chat, and Epstein eventually explained his experiment and asked Castillo whether she would like to be the one. At first, Castillo was reluctant to get involved, but eventually agreed, and on Valentine's Day 2002, Castillo and Epstein signed the love contract. Unfortunately, the couple struggled with the long-distance nature of their relationship. Castillo was based in Venezuela, Epstein in America. And despite several visits to relationship counselors, Castillo and Epstein eventually decided to abandon the experiment after a few months. In 2008, Epstein married a woman he met after giving a lecture on the Isle of Man. Unperturbed by the failure of his personal love project, Epstein has since created a series of exercises designed to promote love outside the laboratory and tested them on students at the University of California, San Diego. These exercises encouraged pairs of strangers to carry out a variety of love-inducing tasks, including gently embracing each other, synchronizing their breathing, gazing longingly into each other's eyes, falling into each other's arms, and getting physically close to each other without touching. Epstein reports that this last exercise apparently often ends with kissing. Epstein asked his romantic guinea pigs to rate the degree to which they felt emotionally close to one another before and after the exercises, with the results showing that afterward, the couples did find each other attractive and did move emotionally closer to one another. The results sounded encouraging. Could this approach to love help those genuinely searching for Cupid's arrow? It was time to find out. Moving on. Struggling to get over a relationship? The as-if principle can help. Researcher Zhuping Li from the National University of Singapore Business School asked 80 people to write down a recent decision they regretted. Li then asked some of the participants to hand their descriptions to a researcher and others to seal it in an envelope. The participants who sealed their experience in an envelope felt significantly better about their past decision compared with those who handed it over. Sealing the description in an envelope meant that the participants were acting as if they had reached psychological closure and were moving on. Next time you want some help getting over the end of a relationship, write a brief description of what happened on a piece of paper, rip up the paper, put it in an envelope, and kiss the past goodbye. And if you really want to have fun, reach for the matches and convert your envelope into a pile of ashes. Speed dating in the fast lane. Speed dating can often be a dull and repetitive process, with people talking about the same topics time and again throughout the evening. I wondered whether it might be possible to use the as-if principle to create a new form of speed dating that was more interesting and effective. I rented a gorgeous Georgian ballroom in the centre of Edinburgh and advertised for single people who wanted to take part in a study exploring the science of seduction. I then invited 20 single men and 20 single women to my love laboratory. Before the start of the evening, we placed candles on each of the tables, turned the lights down low, and piped in romantic music. The scene was set. As each of our participants arrived, they were seated at a long table, men on one side and women on the other. Everyone was handed a book of love containing the instructions for the evening. Once everyone was sitting comfortably, we began. In the first exercise, everyone was asked to chat with the person opposite them and find out the person's name and background. Then we handed everyone a blank cardboard badge and some marker pens and asked everyone to make a badge for their partner. The badge had to incorporate the partner's name and something interesting about him or her. Finally, we asked everyone to give the badge that they had just made to the partner. Loving couples often make and give little gifts to each other, and this exercise was designed to get our participants to behave as if they found each other attractive. At the end of this first exercise, everyone was asked to check one of two boxes to indicate whether they would like to see their partner after the speed dating evening. All of the women then swapped seats, moved on to their next partner, and carried out the second exercise. This process carried on throughout the entire evening, with each exercise involving a different behavior and a different partner. Some of the time, the participants were asked to gaze into each other's eyes or hold hands. At others, they swapped secrets or worked together to achieve a single goal. Everyone had fun staring into each other's eyes and discussing their innermost secrets. But did the exercises help promote that loving feeling? I have run several other conventional speed dating sessions over the years, and around 20% of the encounters result in both participants checking the "Yes, I would like to see this person again" box. When the as-if principle was at work, the success rate was a remarkable 45%. Just spending a few moments behaving as if they found each other attractive was enough to help get in touch with their inner Cupid. At the start of the evening, Leanne and Nick arrived as singletons. Footnote: Leanne and Nick are pseudonyms. When they were paired up, they were asked to take part in a game designed to get couples talking about their lives and touching each other in an acceptable way, and to have fun together. During the game, Leanne and Nick made lots of eye contact and enjoyed the excuse to hold each other's hands. Their chat after the game revealed that the two of them had lots in common and made each other laugh. Both of them indicated that they would like to see each other again, and so I arranged for an email introduction. They arranged to meet for coffee the following week. Once again, everything went very well, and the coffee turned into dinner and a couple of glasses of wine. After meeting again a few days later, Leanne and Nick fell for each other and are now in a loving relationship. The as-if principle can clearly help people get together, but can it make them live happily ever after? The Book of Love. Here are some of the most successful love games used during the experimental speed dating study. With a little ingenuity, they can be used to promote attraction in everyday life. Reading minds, eye contact. Secretly draw a simple picture on a piece of paper. Next, spend 45 seconds staring into your partner's eyes, trying to transmit the drawing to him or her telepathically. Ask your partner to draw the picture that he thinks you were trying to send him on another piece of paper. Finally, compare the two pictures. Spend a few minutes discussing whether the pictures match, why you drew your picture, and why your partner drew his or her picture. Secrets. Sharing secrets. Both you and your partner discuss the following 5 questions. 1. Name something that you have always wanted to do and explain why you haven't done it yet. 2. Imagine that your house or apartment caught fire. You can save only one object. 3. What would it be? 4. What advice would you give your 10-year-old self? 5. What do you like best about your life? 6. When was the last time that you cried with laughter? Knowing me, knowing you. Exploration. Take turns answering the following 5 questions. 1. If you had a superpower, what would it be? 2. Which celebrity would you most like to go to dinner with? 3. If you travel back in time, what era would you visit? 4. If you could have any job in the world, what would it be? 5. If you won the lottery tomorrow, how would you spend the money? Creating a happy ending. When people first fall in love, they tend to go out and about together and try lots of new and exciting experiences. However, as time goes on, it is all too easy for couples to get stuck in a rut. Finding themselves having the same conversations and visiting the same places time and again, they can become bored with each other's company. Indeed, several research projects have discovered that boredom is one of the main sources of an unhappy marriage. Psychologist Arthur Aaron, he of the Shaky Bridge, Blindfolds and Straws fame, wondered whether getting long-term couples to behave as if life was fun again would make them feel more loving toward each other. Aaron recruited 50 married couples who had been together for an average of 14 years and persuaded them to take part in a 10-week experiment. He presented everyone with a long list of activities and asked them to rate how enjoyable and exciting they found each of the items. Next, he split the couples into 2 groups and asked the couples in one group to spend 1.5 hours each week carrying out an activity that they found enjoyable, and the couples in the other group to spend the same amount of time on an activity that they found exciting. At the end of the study, Aaron asked everyone to rate how happy they were with their marriage. Those who had spent time engaging in exciting activities, such as skiing, hiking, dancing, or going to concerts, were significantly happier with their relationships than those who had been encouraged to carry out pleasant activities, such as going to the movies, eating out, or visiting friends. His results show that the key to long-term love involves people avoiding the lure of the familiar and instead inviting excitement into their lives. By acting as if they are out on an exhilarating date, couples can turn back the hands of time and easily recreate that loving feeling. For centuries, scientists have struggled to understand the mysteries of love. According to the small number of conventional theories that have been developed, love makes your heart beat faster and motivates you to stare longingly into your partner's eyes. The as-if principle shows that the exact opposite is true. Behaving as if you are in love can ignite the flames of passion. Encourage complete strangers to hold hands and play footsie, and suddenly Cupid loads his bow ready for action. Have long-term couples behave as if they are reliving the excitement of their first date, and suddenly they find each other irresistible all over again. This simple but important principle can help people find love and live happily ever after. It is not that love changes everything, but that changing your behavior can create the world's most desirable emotion. The Dice Man. This exercise is designed to help existing couples bring back the magic of their first few years together. You and your partner should each complete part one of the exercise separately. Part one. Take a look at each of the following activities and make a note of the ones that you find especially exciting. Go for a walk in the countryside. Go to see a live concert. Play a sport. Plan a trip or vacation. Go on a shopping trip. Go to the beach. Create some kind of artwork. Rearrange or redecorate your home. Go to a sports event. Go to a new restaurant. Go to a lecture or talk. Go camping, hiking or boating. Invite friends to dinner. Learn to windsurf. Go dancing. Visit a fair or zoo. Get a massage or go to a health club. Plan a major purchase. Visit a museum or art exhibition. Go to a movie. Go for a ride in a speedboat. Eat snails. Fly a kite. Go on a road trip. Bet on a horse race. Kiss on a fairground ride. Place a pin in a map and go to that place. Enter a trivia quiz in a bar. Learn some circus skills. Go canoeing. Arm wrestle. Dive or jump off a high board. Sleep out under the stars. Fly in a seaplane. Go on a long train journey. Ride on a huge roller coaster. Travel on a hot air balloon. Swim with some dolphins. Do a parachute jump. Now consider two other activities that you find exciting. Part 2. Sit down with your partner and look at your ratings and answers. Select 6 activities that both you and your partner find exciting. Write them on a piece of paper and number them 1 to 6. In the early 1970s, author Luke Reinhardt published a novel entitled The Dice Man. The book tells the story of a psychiatrist who starts to make major decisions based on the role of a die. It is time for you to play the role of the Dice Man. Find a die, roll it, and read out the corresponding chosen activity. Ensure that you carry out this activity during the next 2 weeks and repeat this process every 2 weeks. Chapter 3. Mental Health. Where we meet the Napoleon of neuroses, find out why watching sports is bad for your health, and discover how best to deal with phobias, anxiety, and depression. Action is the antidote to despair. Joan Baez. 1. Paralysis and emotion. As you listen to this, millions of people across the world are struggling with some form of psychological disorder. Some will be trying to live with an irrational phobia, others will be overly anxious, and many will be depressed. For more than a century, scientists and psychologists have attempted to cure these problems. They have adopted many different perspectives, including giving people drugs, operating on their brains, and talking to them. Can the as-if principle help people to move away from the dark side? William James first outlined his radical theory in an essay entitled, What is an Emotion? The essay ended with a brave and bold prediction. If behavior created feelings, then people who were totally paralyzed shouldn't be able to experience emotion. James also realized that it would be tricky to carry out this test, in part because of the difficulties in determining the emotional life of someone who was completely immobile. It must be confessed that a crucial test of the truth of the hypothesis is quite as hard to obtain as its decisive refutation. 8 years after James wrote his now classic essay, researchers devised a clever way of carrying out a version of his test, and in doing so, laid the foundations for a new approach to pain management, phobias, anxiety, and depression. To appreciate their remarkable study, it is important to understand what is happening inside your body. You are amazing. Really, you are. At this very moment, millions of electrical impulses are zipping around a biological superhighway that covers you from head to toe. One lane of this highway is carrying information from your sensory receptors to your brain. These receptors will be hard at work as you listen to these sentences. If you are sitting down, the receptors in your legs and buttocks will be continuously sending, "I am being squashed by the weight of my upper body," signals to your brain. Your bladder and digestive system are also using the superhighway to tell your brain whether you need to go to the bathroom or get something to eat. Similarly, the million or so fibers that continually carry information from the back of your eye to your brain will be buzzing with excitement, busily communicating the shape of each letter on a page and delighted to get a name check in such a prestigious book. The other lane in the biological superhighway carries information in the opposite direction, transmitting signals from your brain to your body. If you are sitting down at the moment, these impulses will be continually sending small signals to your major muscles to ensure that you remain balanced on the chair. When your brain gets excited, it uses the highway to send signals that speed up your heart and increase your rate of breathing. The superhighway starts at the base of your brain, runs down your spine, and is peppered with junctions that allow information to travel to and from various parts of your body. Junctions toward the base of your spine take information to and from your feet and legs. Those toward the middle of the highway carry impulses to and from your hands and arms. And those toward the top of the highway communicate with your face and eyes. Similarly, information to and from your bladder joins the highway toward the bottom of your spine. Your digestive organs join slightly farther up, and your heart is controlled by signals coming from the junctions toward the top of the spine. If this entire complex system of interconnected signals were to suddenly fail, you would experience multiple organ failure and die in an instant. However, the good news is that for most people, the system works extremely well. Each moment of your life, information zips around the highways and byways of your body and brain, allowing you to perceive your surroundings, move around, and stay alive. Not only that, but the entire system has evolved to operate outside conscious control, allowing you to focus on the finer things in life, such as appreciating great art, trying to understand scientific advances, and finding a plumber on a Sunday. In the mid-1960s, psychologist George Homan was working at a Veterans Administration hospital in Arizona. Homan was a paraplegic and realized that his patients provided a unique opportunity to test James's immobility will prevent emotion prediction. Many of Homan's patients were paralyzed because they had suffered an injury to their spinal cord, and the level at which the injury had occurred was directly related to their degree of immobility. An injury toward the base of the spine, for example, would have severed the lower part of the superhighway, and so resulted in a loss of movement and feeling in the legs. In contrast, an injury higher up the spine would have disrupted a much larger part of the highway, and so resulted in a loss of feeling and movement in both the legs and arms. Homan realized that if James were correct, the higher the lesion on the spine, and therefore the less bodily movement, the greater the loss in emotional experience. Homan tracked down patients who had received an injury to one of five sections of the spine and interviewed them about their emotional experiences. In one part of his study, Homan asked his patients to compare how often they were afraid before and after their injury. Patients with injuries to the lower parts of their spine reported very little difference, while those with lesions toward the top of the spine reported becoming fearless. The patients' reports provide a remarkable insight into life without emotion, with one fearless patient noting, "Sometimes I act angry when I see some injustice. I yell and cuss and raise hell, because if you don't do it sometimes, I've learned people will take advantage of you. But it just doesn't have the heat to it that it used to. It's a mental kind of anger." When Homan asked the patients about other emotions, such as grief, the same pattern emerged. The higher the spinal damage, the less able they were to move around, and the less likely they were to experience emotion. Homan's findings are a remarkable tribute to James's genius and demonstrate the vital role that your body plays in determining how you feel. Exactly as James predicted over 80 years before, the higher the damaged area is on the spine, the more dramatic the drop is in emotional experience. More recently, other researchers wanted to discover whether James's idea is also true for facial expressions. Would people who are unable to move their faces show a drop in emotional experiences? The researchers could have spent years tracking down people with different levels of facial paralysis and then assessing their emotional experiences. Instead, they adopted a lateral approach to the problem and saved themselves a great deal of time and trouble by working with an easily available group of people who had voluntarily paralyzed their own faces. Botox, or as it is known in scientific circles, botulinum toxin, is one of the most popular cosmetic treatments in the world. Originally developed to help people suffering from facial muscle spasms, Botox paralyzes the nerves that cause the facial muscles to contract. In the early 1990s, researchers discovered that injecting the chemical into the frown lines between the eyes caused partial paralysis of the forehead and so significantly reduced wrinkling. Although this can result in a more youthful appearance, it can also sometimes make people's faces appear a tad expressionless and robotic. Joshua Ian Davis from Barnard College and his colleagues wondered whether such attempts to turn back time could form the basis of a remarkable test of James's theory. He recruited two groups of women for the experiment. One group had just undergone treatment with Botox injections, while the other group had opted for a different treatment that involved injecting a kind of filler into the forehead. Both treatments aimed to create a more youthful appearance, but only the Botox paralyzed the facial muscles. Davis asked the women to watch several video clips, including a scary clip of a man eating live worms, a hilarious clip from America's Funniest Videos, and a serious documentary about Jackson Pollock. After seeing each of the clips, the women were asked to rate how they felt. Compared with those who had had the filler treatment, the Botox women reported less of an emotional reaction to the clips. The evidence is that James was right. Immobility, in this instance of facial expressions, causes a loss in emotional experience. The message from the patients with spinal injuries and the woman injecting Botox is clear. Inhibiting people's behavior and facial expressions prevents them from feeling certain emotions. On the downside, such individuals are less likely to experience positive emotions such as happiness and joy. However, on the upside, they are also less likely to feel negative emotions such as anger and anxiety. Researchers became curious and began to examine whether this latter result could be used to help avoid unwelcome feelings. 2. Eliminating pain, anger, and anxiety. In the 1970s, British doctor Peter Brown visited a children's hospital in China to observe how doctors there carried out tonsillectomies. Brown was stunned by what he saw. Patients undergoing tonsillectomies in the West often reported experiencing a great deal of pain. In China, the situation was quite different. Brown reported seeing a line of smiling five-year-olds standing outside the doctor's surgical unit. Each child was given a quick anesthetic throat spray by a nurse and then led into the room. Once inside, the still smiling child climbed onto a table and opened his or her mouth. Within seconds, the doctor whipped out the tonsils and dropped them into a bucket of water. The child walked to a recovery room, showing few signs of discomfort. The vast difference in discomfort by patients undergoing tonsillectomies in the West and China illustrates the subjective nature of pain. It isn't an isolated example. Often people experience exactly the same hospital operation, event, illness, or accident, but report very different levels of pain. Why should this be the case? According to the as-if principle, a large part of the answer has to do with different ways in which they behave. Some social psychology experiments involve telling participants that they are administering dangerous electric shocks to another person when, in reality, the shocks are harmless and the other person is a stooge. However, before the creation of university ethics committees, an era that many psychologists nostalgically refer to as the good old days, some studies did actually administer genuine and painful shocks to volunteers. One such study was conducted by John Lanzetta and his colleagues from Dartmouth College. Lanzetta invited volunteers to his laboratory one at a time and connected them to two machines. First, the experimenters placed electrodes on the volunteers' legs and left hand and plugged the wires into an electric shock generator. Then they attached sweat sensors to the volunteers' right hand in order to be able to continuously measure the person's stress levels. After ensuring that the machines were ready to shock and sense, the experimenters retreated to an adjoining room. A closed-circuit television system ensured that the experimenters could see, talk to, and hear the participant. They told the volunteer that he or she was about to receive a series of electric shocks of varying intensity, and that the participant was to rate the pain associated with each shock by calling out a number between 1, whatever, to 100. Just you wait until you come back in here. The experimenters then administered 20 electric shocks and carefully noted down the numbers each volunteer screamed out. After a short break, Lanzetta explained that there was going to be a second series of shocks, but that this time the volunteers should do their best to hide how they felt. Each volunteer was asked to play tough, squash any emotional expressions, avoid screaming, and adopt a relaxed posture. A second round of 20 shocks was then administered, and each time the participants shouted out their ratings. The results were quite remarkable. When the volunteers acted as if they were not in any discomfort, they experienced much lower levels of pain. Not only that, but the data from the sweat sensors revealed that they were indeed far less stressed. The study has been repeated many times over the years, and the same results have been attained. This rather counterintuitive effect helps explain why the Chinese children appeared so unperturbed during the tonsillectomies. At the time of Peter Brown's visit, Chinese children were taught to view operations in a positive way, and so would often smile and behave in a relaxed way when undergoing medical procedures. The effect also helps explain several other curious pain-related phenomena. For example, people experience less pain during minor medical procedures if they look away from the incision or injection. In doing so, they are far less likely to adopt a pained facial expression or tense up, and so feel less discomfort. The same goes for other effective pain reduction techniques that involve distraction, such as imagery, hypnosis, and relaxation techniques. Each time, people are behaving as if they are not in any discomfort, and this causes them to experience less pain. Inspired by this effect, researchers then examined whether behaving as if you are a strong and powerful person would result in even lower levels of pain. Vanessa Bones from the University of Toronto and colleagues told a group of volunteers that they were taking part in a study about the health benefits of exercise at work. Some of the volunteers were asked to adopt a posture associated with dominance and power by puffing out their chests and moving their arms away from their body. In contrast, others were encouraged to curl up in a powerless-looking ball. Next, the experimenters placed a tourniquet around each volunteer's arm and slowly inflated it. The band slowly reduced blood flow and so became increasingly painful, and volunteers were asked to say when they could no longer tolerate the discomfort. Remarkably, those in the powerful posture were able to tolerate much tighter tourniquets than those curled up in a ball. Behaving as if they were powerful and strong helped push away an unwanted emotion and showed that the age-old expression, "keep your chin up," may be literally true. Results from the early work into the as-if principle and pain motivated researchers to examine whether the same idea could be used to help minimize other unwanted emotions. Could it, for example, help pour cold water on those seeing red? You wouldn't like me when I am angry. Anger is bad for you. It often makes you act foolishly, take irrational risks, blurt out comments that you later regret, and lash out. The vast majority of murders committed in the United States are due at least in part to the effects of anger. It is also bad for those around you. Psychologist Martin Seligman tracked the lives of 400 children for 5 years, focusing on families in which the parents routinely fought with each other. Seligman's findings show that the children from warring families were more likely to be diagnosed with depression and struggle later in life. What is the best way of keeping your inner Hulk under control? To find out, we have to travel back to the turn of the last century and spend some quality time with one of the world's most famous psychologists, Jean-Martin Charcot, described as the Napoleon of the neuroses. A charismatic lecturer with a flair for the dramatic, this 19th century French clinician paved the way for modern neurology, has more than 15 diseases named in his honour, and carried out groundbreaking research into the causes of both multiple sclerosis and Parkinson's disease. Despite such impressive achievements, Charcot is best known for his remarkable journeys into the unconscious mind. Charcot was fascinated by the secret life of the brain. To carry out his investigations, he frequently teamed up with patients from Parisian insane asylums and embarked on bizarre explorations into the unconscious. Much of the work was carried out live as Charcot lectured to fellow doctors. In 1887, the French artist André Breuillet attended several of Charcot's lectures and painted the Napoleon of neuroses in action. The image shows Charcot standing on the right-hand side of the painting wearing a fashionable black suit. On the left of the scene, a group of around 30 men are carefully watching Charcot and taking notes. An unconscious woman is draped across Charcot's outstretched left arm. The woman in Breuillet's painting is one of Charcot's star performers, Blanche Wittmann. Described by historians at the time as having a large and strong body with very large bosoms, Wittmann had been admitted to an asylum after having several attacks of hysteria, frequently urinating on herself, and admitting to sexual intercourse with her employer. During his lectures, Charcot would place Wittmann into a hypnotic trance and then ask her to exhibit a range of strange phenomena, including falling into a catatonic state, maintaining an odd arched position by balancing on top of her head and the points of her feet, performing mirror writing, and making selected words appear scratched on her skin. Charcot argued that these phenomena were manifestations of Wittmann's unconscious mind, and so could be used to explore the innermost workings of the brain. At the end of each session, Charcot would compress Wittmann's ovarian region to awaken her from the trance, whereupon she would return to the land of the living with her pupils greatly dilated. Charcot's dramatic approach to the human psyche quickly became the talk of the town, and academics from across Europe travelled to see his curious demonstrations. In 1885, a 29-year-old Austrian physician named Sigmund Freud attended one of Charcot's demonstrations. Before seeing Charcot in action, Freud had intended to pursue a career in medicine and had previously carried out a considerable amount of research in which he had dissected hundreds of eels in an unsuccessful search for their reproductive organs. After seeing Charcot dilate the pupils of several young female patients, Freud became convinced that the unconscious played a key role in a number of psychological disorders. After taking vast amounts of cocaine, and with a cigar rarely out of his mouth, make of that what you will, Freud eventually came up with a dramatically new form of psychology known as psychoanalysis. According to Freud, people tend to push unwanted thoughts out of their conscious awareness and into the unconscious. Once there, the threatening thoughts bubble away and build up psychic energy. When they have gained sufficient psychological strength, the thoughts start to affect consciousness in a variety of unhealthy ways, creating, for example, feelings of unease, neurosis, and anxiety. Freud believed that it was psychologically healthy to get rid of these repressed thoughts before they became too powerful, and he attempted to develop therapeutic techniques that could act as a release valve for the unconscious mind. Initially, following in the footsteps of Charcot, Freud started off by trying to hypnotize his patients. When this had little effect, Freud promptly abandoned the method and instead explored several other approaches, including dream analysis, where the therapist attempts to reveal the symbolic meaning of patients' dreams, and free association, where the patient is asked to say the first word that enters his or her head, when the therapist says carefully chosen stimulus words, such as chair, table, and orgasm. Applying these techniques to his own unconscious, Freud became convinced that he had developed sexual feelings toward his mother when he was around 2 years old. Freud's ideas quickly caught on, and by the turn of the last century, psychoanalysis was starting to spread across the world. In 1909, Freud was invited to Clark University in Massachusetts to give a series of prestigious lectures. It was the only time that he spoke in America, and he used the opportunity to deliver an overview of his beloved psychoanalysis. At the time of Freud's visit, William James was 67 years old and suffering from a painful heart condition. Despite his poor health, he travelled to Clark University to hear Freud talk. James was less than impressed, later describing Freud's idea of dream symbolism as a dangerous method, and believing that the great psychoanalyst himself was both deluded and obsessed by fixed ideas. James and Freud differed on many topics, including the causes and treatment of excessive anger. According to Freud, people became angry because they were repressing violent thoughts, and it would therefore be cathartic for them to release these feelings in a safe way by, for example, punching a pillow, shouting and screaming, or stamping their feet. In contrast, James's theory predicted that people become angry because they are behaving in an angry way, and that Freud's cathartic therapy would simply make them angrier. For years, psychologists have carried out studies to discover which of the two great thinkers was right. One of the first into the fray was sociologist Murray Strauss from the University of New Hampshire. In the early 1970s, Strauss became concerned with what he saw as the overly Freudian advice being given to couples struggling to maintain their relationship. Much of this advice came from the therapeutic aggression movement, which thought that couples shouldn't hold back when it came to telling each other what they thought. Manuals from the time encouraged couples to get rid of your pent-up hostilities, let it be totally vicious, and to bite a plastic baby's bottle while imagining that it is their partner. To find out if such radical behavior helped or hindered a relationship, Strauss carried out a simple study. He reasoned that if the cathartic theory were valid, couples that are verbally aggressive should be less likely to carry out acts of actual physical aggression toward each other. Strauss also realized that couples might not be the best ones to report accurately on their aggressive behavior, and so asked his students to secretly monitor their parents' level of verbal and physical aggression. More than 300 students carefully completed checklists about how their parents responded when they were faced with a problem. Did they tend to discuss the issue in a constructive way? Did they become verbally aggressive, perhaps yelling and storming out of the room? Did they become physically aggressive, perhaps throwing objects at each other or hitting their partner? When Strauss analyzed the results, an obvious pattern emerged. The more the couples engaged in verbal aggression, the more likely they were to be physically aggressive. Just as James predicted, shouting and yelling wasn't cathartic. Rather, it encouraged people to behave in an angry way. Freud nil, James won. Next were studies carried out in the workplace. Ebba Eberson from the University of California, San Diego, and his colleagues discovered that a local engineering firm was going to lay off many of its employees. The employees had every right to be angry because they had been promised a 3-year contract but were being put out of work after just 1 year. Eberson interviewed some of the employees in one of two ways. One group was encouraged to talk about how angry they were at the firm. So, how do you feel about the way in which you have been treated? While the other group was asked much more neutral questions. So, can you describe the firm's technical library? After the interviews, all of the employees rated their level of hostility and anger toward the company. Did those who had been encouraged to rant and rave show lower levels of hostility? No. Once again, the exact opposite pattern of results emerged. The employees who had vented their feelings of anger were much more hostile than those who had been asked about the company's technical library. Freud nil, James 2. Finally, there is the work investigating the link between hostility and watching sports. When people attend football games, they often cheer on their team and shout abuse at the opposition. Freudians had argued that such aggressive behaviour was cathartic, so people would feel significantly less hostile after the game. In contrast, proponents of James's ideas thought that all of the shouting and jeering would make people feel far angrier. Jeffrey Goldstein from Temple University decided to discover which camp was correct. Goldstein arranged for a small army of researchers to attend a major American football game. Before the start of the game, the researchers hung around the stadium turnstiles and interviewed a randomly selected group of spectators. The interviews were short and included asking each spectator which team he or she supported and how aggressive he or she felt. Once the game had ended, the researchers took to the turnstiles again and interviewed randomly selected spectators as they left the game. The results revealed that regardless of whether the spectators' team won or lost, the spectators were significantly more aggressive after the game. Worried that this increase in aggression might be due to spectators being in a crowd or simply watching a competitive situation, Goldstein reassembled his crack research team and had them carry out the same interviews at a local gymnastics competition. Although the spectators attending the gymnastics event were crowded together in a competitive context, they didn't shout and jeer, and weren't significantly more aggressive after the event. Goldstein's data suggested that the football game encouraged the spectators to behave in an aggressive way, and that this behavior made them feel more hostile. Freud nil, James 3. Such induced hostility can have a very real impact on society. Glasgow, in Scotland, has two professional football clubs. Celtic is based in the east of Glasgow and has traditionally had support from the Catholic community, while Rangers has its base in the southwest of the city and has historically attracted a Protestant following. The clubs have a long-standing and fierce rivalry, with supporters from both sides often singing hostile and intimidating chants during matches. In 2011, researchers working for the Scottish Police compared the levels of reported crime after Rangers-Celtic matches with times when the teams were not playing. The figures are remarkable. When Rangers played Celtic on Saturday lunchtimes, violent crime in Glasgow almost tripled, and incidents of domestic abuse more than doubled. The power of calm. Psychologist Brad Bushman from Iowa State University has carried out several experiments showing how feelings of anger can be quickly squashed by acting like a calm person. In one study, for example,